This Aiden with Oddball Pilot. I'm sitting down with Nate Martin, who's the chief pilot of Northern Air Cargo. Northern Air Cargo is one of the legendary all-cargo operators in Alaska. And I first was aware of Northern Air Cargo when I was first got my first job in Bethel flying for UDAIR, and I used to jump seat out on the DC-6s. And it was probably one of the highlights of the shift was actually flying on the old 6 out to Bethel, where I'd jump in my 207 and buzz around. Northern Air Cargo has gone through several transformations in terms of aircraft changes and an ownership change. But they're alive and well, in fact, thriving, I would say, here in Anchorage. And we're going to talk about sort of the history of Northern Air Cargo and how they got to where they are today. So let's start with you, Nate. When did you get into flying?
Well, I got into flying basically right after I was born. My dad's always been a pilot, and when I was, I think, even very, very young, maybe 3-4 months old, it took me for a first ride in a T-Craft. And he told me that all I wanted to do the whole time was grab the yoke and fly the airplane. So even at just a very young age. So it was something that I was kind of born into. You know, if my dad flew, I've flown, you know, and now I'm infecting my son with the disease as well.
So. And most of those early years were up here in Alaska.
Yes. We moved to Alaska in 1979, and my dad came up here to fly. And he was working as an engineer before that, and, you know, he had the flying bug, and he wanted to fly, so we came to Alaska and started flying out in Dillingham and whatnot, and just kind of bounced around from airline to airline for a little while, and then we kind of settled in. Unfortunately, he kind of, after a while, got out of flying and started working on the slope and whatnot, but we've always had airplanes, and my dad and I own a 180 together.
And a T-6.
And he owns a T-6, yeah. So it's been an interesting ride. So to answer your question, yeah, I started with my dad.
Yeah, and your whole life.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing you got your license then at 16. And,
actually got my license right after, about 2 weeks after I got it when I was 18.
Okay.
About 2 weeks after I got out of high school, I was working for Northern Air Cargo. I had just started working here.
And
had to ask for a couple days off to go. Or day off to go take my check ride.
So you were working cargo back then for Northern Air Cargo?
I was working, but what happened was I graduated high school, and my hopes and dreams were to go play college hockey, ice hockey.
Oh, wow.
At the time. That's what was important at the time. But what happened was I was going around from airport to airport looking for a summer job, and I happened into the Woods Air Hangar out in Palmer.
Uh-huh.
And I talked with Warren Woods at the time, and he told me, you know, he said, I don't have as much, you know, maybe I got some airplane cleaning or something for you to do. And I told him, I'll do anything, just looking for a summer job. Later that night, he called me up and said, hey, I just rented out my hangar to Northern Air Cargo. They're going to have some special projects. They're going to use the hangar all summer. If you are interested, come out and talk to them in the morning. And I did, and got hired on as a mechanics helper. And worked as a mechanics helper for about, it ended up working out to where I started, finished the projects out in Palmer, and then we moved, and those ended, and they told me to come in and work in Anchorage, and I worked in Anchorage and was somehow able to, I think due to the fact that I was such a cheap help, they kept me on even through a bunch of people getting laid off.
Right.
And it just worked out to where, you know, a couple of years later, I got my AMP license and then started working as an AMP, worked my way through up to a lead mechanic and a temporary inspector. And I worked in the hangar for about 7 years, and then the opportunity to come fly came along, and I jumped at it.
So you've been with Northern Air Cargo your whole career?
My whole career.
So you've seen a lot of the changes go through. That's what were they flying back in when you started? Was it the
D6s? It was the DC-6, strictly the DC-6 back then. The company started off history wise, you know, with the C-82s, and then, you know, I believe there were some DC-3s that Schulten and Carlson owned for a little while, and then the C-82s, and then the DC-6 being the major workhorse of the company for the majority of the years.
And the 82, is that the boxcar?
Yes.
The clamshell, the twin tail, the clamshells, yeah.
Like, people get the boxcar and the 119 confused.
I was going to say.
Because I think the 119 is technically the boxcar. The C-82 is the packet, they call it. That's what was it military kind of derivative, and it had just had different engines on it. I believe both of them were built by Fairchild, but same design, same everything. Just the 119 was a little later version of it.
Okay, I've always called it the 119, so that's good to know. Yeah. Good for my own knowledge. They all have a little jet engine on the top.
Yep, yep.
Running off avgas?
Yes, they did. Burning it like no tomorrow.
I said, yeah, that would have been a cool plane.
Yeah.
So did you work your way up the flying side through the flight engineer seat,
yes.
Right seat, left seat?
Yeah, when I was working as a mechanic, I got sent out on a couple of road trips.
Okay.
We'd go down and we were doing some flying. We were hauling fuel out of Wrangell into the Bronson Creek mine.
Okay.
Up on the Canada side of the Stikine River.
And was that Everett's Air Fuel then?
No, that was Northern Air Cargo at the time.
Okay.
Northern Air Fuel hadn't come about yet.
Got it.
But we were doing that flying, and I went down to maintain, you know, as a mechanic to maintain the airplanes and keep them going. And a couple of the crews would let me fly with them, you know, and put me in the seat and let me fly in the flight engineer seat. You know, so there was a couple of those guys that were really instrumental in saying, hey, you know, you need to go talk to the chief pilot, go talk to the chief pilot. So I did when I got back, and they were kind of like, well, we didn't really like to hire out of the hangar anymore. We want people with pilot credentials and that kind of thing.
Plus, they need AMPs.
And at the time, yeah, they needed AMPs. So, but I just kind of hung in there, and then there was a chief pilot change, and that chief pilot had kind of was some of those guys that I had flown with were saying, hey, you know, there's a couple guys in the hangar that would be good. And he called me up and said, hey, you still interested? And I was very much interested.
Yeah.
So, and the rest is kind of history there.
Well, I flew for Everett's Air Fuel for a year and a half.
Okay.
And the engineers who had been AMPs were way better engineers.
Yeah.
I mean, I did, that was mostly right seat, but do you know Jeremy Erickson?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so Jeremy, he'd come along and he'd be our engineer, but he was senior to me, so we'd switch, he'd sit right seat sometimes to try to teach me to be an engineer.
Right.
And to watch him in the engineer seat, I mean, he could read the spec. I mean, he just knew everything, whereas I'm struggling to keep the engines running.
Right.
It's
when you, we had some guys that were professional flight engineers, and to fly with those guys was always just, you know, the temperatures never moved.
Yeah.
You know, everything was just rock solid. You'd call for a power change and it was already set. You know, and it's like, you know, they knew, you know, it was as much of them landing the airplane in a lot of cases as it was you.
Yeah,
you
they know. Could see right where that's
right.
Same thing, like check
even
rides, grease.
Flying a tight ILS approach, you know, you're over there concentrating and you know, you can feel the power just moving, you know, back and forth because they're just keeping you right on speed and helping us maintain that glide. When you had a good engineer, it was really nice. When you didn't have one, you were in for a little bit more work. You know.
You had to think, you had to direct your engineer what to do in that case.
Sometimes, pull
it back 2 inches, give me half an inch.
Right, you know, and it's all a guess, you know. And you got to the point, too, where you would, you know, move it yourself.
Right,
you know,
and they'd just even them up.
And just even them up.
Yeah.
You get what you need. But like I say, you get those guys that were really good that they'd have it already done for you.
Jeremy was really good.
Yeah.
And Russ Peters, who's flying for him in Kenai now, by the end of that year, he was kind of right there, too.
Yeah.
He knew what we wanted.
Sure.
Did you make captain of the six?
I did. Yep. I lucked. I had impeccable timing, not through any ability or anything, but I was in the right place at the right time by chance, because we, at Northern Air, I was flying engineer. I went and finished, you know, got the rest of my ratings that I needed to make first officer, and it was kind of a strange deal. There was going to be a layoff, and they went to a bunch of the engineers above me saying, hey, look, if you want, there was a flight engineer check airman job open. I said, if you want it, it's yours. And they went down, and nobody wanted it
until
they got to me, and they said, and I was kind of the last one on the list, so they said, it came to me, and they said, well, you know, if you take the job, you know, you'll skip the furlough that's going to happen, and we'll get you a right seat checkout once you finish your ratings. Not necessarily a quicker upgrade, but they'd give me the checkout. You know, I'd be qualified to fly. So I jumped on that, and with that, they kind of gave me the time to go down and finish. I still had to get my multi and my commercial.
Okay.
So they gave me a month because they were doing some furloughing anyways. They gave me a month. I went down. I got finished getting my ratings, and I came back, and then I did the flight engineer. I was doing a lot of engineer training. But they also kept their word and trained me up as a a first officer, so when I would go out and fly, I could legally swap seats and fly, you know, fly in front.
Right, if so, empty legs or...
Yeah, exactly. And
what year was that, just for my own sense of timing?
That was had to have been around 2000.
Okay.
Yeah, 99, 2000.
That kind of fit, yeah, because I remember that right around then there were some layoffs and furloughs.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
A little disquiet over right. here, it seemed like.
But then, so I had made, I'd gotten that first officer, and I'd flown for, I'd gotten to where I'd amassed about 1,000 hours of first officer time.
Okay.
And then there was a mass exodus of pilots from here
yep.
that went to, there was a bunch of our jet pilots that went to Atlas at the time.
Oh, yep.
They left, they too. Went, they, yeah. And there was just a bunch of them, very, very senior guys. And they all left and went to Atlas, which then a lot of the more senior guys came out of six and went into the jet, which just left the door open. And at first, I didn't have enough time to get an ATP yet.
Right.
But it then, through just, I had to wait, maybe I got, had to get a pass up one or two captain opportunities as a first officer.
Let it build up the time to get the
well, ATP. I build up the time and then finally was able to get my ATP, and I actually got my ATP and my DC-6 type rating at the same time.
Same, right.
So the company really helped me out for that years ago. But it was, the timing was just impeccable, and I got to fly. I ended up with about 3,000 hours of captain time in the six.
Cool. I love that plane. It was a nice flying plane.
Oh, I do too. I'd go back and fly it if I could.
Yeah, I really liked it. So the jet you're referring to, that time it was a 727.
727.
Yeah. And those kind of didn't work out super well.
It was a great airplane. It just got to be too maintenance intensive.
Okay.
The C-checks were starting to top million and a half. You know, they were getting real. They were old. We had old 100s. And
right.
they were just getting, excuse me.
Feet up. And
they were just getting too expensive to operate.
I always heard, to the size, they're a little too big. Like, their load was more than the DC-6.
Oh, yeah, it was quite a bit more.
Yeah, and the 6 was kind of like the perfect mainline load.
And
it was. So you're always finding ways to do multiple stops.
Excuse me.
Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, no, it, the 7.2, yeah, it had about, it could, depending on where, what your leg stage length was, it could carry up to a 40,000 pound payload.
Yeah.
And, so there was places that it worked great. You know, Red Dog loved it. Red Dog, we've had that contract for a number of years.
Right.
They loved the fact that we could carry 40,000 pounds in there. They'd stuff that thing.
Save them money.
Full. And, you know, we go up there twice a week now. We're back then with the 2.7. We don't go once a week.
Okay.
But as far as the airplane fitting, you know, that airplane had such a wide performance envelope. It was incredible. I mean, it had lightweight landing speeds down, you know, VREFs at about, you know, 110 knots. When it was super light and low
like
on gas and everything, but and so it would fly really slow, but it would also just haul butt around the state. I mean, we would cruise that thing at 8.4 everywhere we went. I mean,
wow. So you flew
I flew the 2.7 for a while.
Did you make captain of that?
I did. Yeah, I went straight from the 6 captain
left
in the 6
to left seat.
Yeah.
I've always heard the 727 is a pilot's plane.
It is. It is. And you know, when I first went to the 7.2, I had a friend of mine that had flown 7.2s for years, and he told me, he says, if you're a good airman, you'll like the 7.2. If you're not, you won't.
Huh.
And I didn't understand what that meant until we started flying the 737s. Because
okay.
the 737 became the push-button managing type, where the 7.2 was still a hand-flown. You know, the autopilot wasn't worth a darn. Usually, you hand flew that every approach was hand flown. I used to shut off the autopilot at 10,000 feet in that thing and just fly it and fly it in. You know, which we don't do that in the 7.2. 7.2 is, like I say, it's become, or 7.3, it's become a management thing. You know, where,
well, you don't even have the newest. So you've got this.
No,
this,
ours are
200s.
Ours are 200s. We have 200s and 300s.
Okay,
our 300s are parked down in Laredo right now, but. But we do have fairly late model autopilots in them. They're all capable of auto land and everything else. So yeah, being, your life became a lot less stressful going into that airplane. But it also doesn't take, like I said, the airmanship to
right.
operate. You know, it's still a flying airplane. You know, and it hand flies. It's a good hand flying airplane. But it's.
You don't need to.
Yeah.
I go off these tangents periodically. With the better autopilot, and pilots certainly utilize the autopilot. I mean, they should. Mm-hmm. It's a tool. Do you see in check rides that some of the airmanship skills are decreasing?
Not with our guys, because most of our guys fly hand will shut it off and hand fly quite
right.
a bit, especially up here in Alaska, because it's just what we've all done.
Right.
But I can definitely see where
it could happen.
It can happen. You know, it's people do. You know, if you, it's easy to become. I'm not going to say dependent because I don't like that. I don't like that connotation that
right.
people are dependent on the autopilot, but it definitely is easy to. I don't know what word to use there necessarily, but
yeah,
it's could be. I don't know if complacency is the right thing or whatever, but you know, it's if
lazy.
Yeah, that's you know, that's one way to put it, I guess. But
I've certainly when autopilot, you know, it does become easy to just use the autopilot necessary.
And, right.
I think one of my practices has always been to turn it off for the climb. Mm-hmm. And the descent, just have it off a cruise.
Right.
Just
right.
And of course, I'm talking about caravans and
right.
smaller planes, but it just keeps some sense of airmanship in.
Yeah. That's the thing. You got to fly the thing every once in a while, you know. And I kind of contradict myself here. It's 737, it's not the most comfortable hand flying airplane because it's got those low slung engines.
Oh,
so every power change, it changes the pitch on the damn thing. So if you're jockeying the throttle around, you're constantly not uncommanded, but not commanded by the elevator pitch changes that you're having to fight with. So sometimes it's just easier to leave the autopilot on because you're just not sitting there fighting, especially in a sort of a slight wind shear or
right.
turbulence.
Right
approach or whatever, but
it does. But other than that, it does fly.
It's not a bad flying airplane. It's a very, 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 very easy airplane to fly.
Did you, when you were switching from the 6 to the 2.7, did you find any difficulty with that transition, or was it?
I was about 100 miles behind it everywhere I went for the first.
Just
oh,
fast.
I flew it. I flew. I had 1,100 hours in it. And I think for about the first 1,000, I was. it wasn't that. I found myself catching up, but that was the hardest part, was just catching up with it. But the fact that I didn't have to chase an autopilot or figure out I was flying the airplane. I wasn't managing it so much.
Right, right.
You know, it was a hand flown deal. Whereas that's where I felt bad for the guys that came out of the 6 that went straight into the 7.3, because it's a completely different philosophy in flying. You know, now you're pushing buttons and managing the thing as opposed to just being a hand fly. So I think that I had the advantage by going to the 2.7, learning, because the 2.7 was still hand flown, but it was fast
and it was jets
and it when it was jets and it was the whole nine yards. But then moving into the 7.3 from the 2.7 was more okay. Now this is, I'm used to going fast. Now I got a little bit of time to figure out how to manage this thing.
Right.
Whereas the 6 guys, which we had a handful, 5 or 6 guys that when we finally stopped flying the DC-6, they came straight out of the jet and went into the 6 and went into the
3.7.
Into the 3.7. And I think those guys had a harder time with it than I did, for sure.
Interesting. Well, you definitely, I mean, you only had two 2.7s?
We only ever had 2 on the property at a time.
Okay.
We kind of went through a... I think maybe we had 3 at one time, but I don't remember. I'm not 100% sure on that. I can't remember. It's a long time ago.
Yeah,
but
that was early 2000. Probably.
Yeah, yeah. And to be honest with you, when I was flying the 6, I was happier than a pig in shit, to be honest with you. So I didn't pay attention to really what was going on with the jets or anything else. I'm just happy to be flying that thing because it was such a fun airplane.
I was shocked. I flew the C-46 first forever, and then switching the 6, I thought it would be as hard to fly as the 46, which had maybe harder because more engines.
Yeah.
And it was just a joking light on the controls.
Yeah.
Draw straight off.
Yeah.
It's a good plane.
It's a great flying.
Yeah.
Plane. Yeah.
How many 37s do you have now? You've got.
We have 4 right
okay.
at the moment.
You keep one down in Laredo.
We keep 2 down in Laredo.
Okay.
So both of our 300 models are down in Laredo. And there's kind of a constant state of flux. Sometimes, like here in July, we're going to bring a 300 up here,
okay,
to help us out with whatever fish haul there might be, or we're actually cycling out our 200s up here
okay.
for C-check, so we have to save a little bit of time so they fall within the planned time that we have them for C-check.
Right, right.
So we're bringing the 300 up here to kind of save a little bit. Because the airplanes down south, you know, when they're busy, but they're not always busy. And so they will sit for fairly good periods of time sometimes. We've had a good year this year. We had a really good year this year. Last year was awful. It was, I think, for the first 8 months of last year, we didn't hardly fly at all.
That's kind of what Zirkle was saying about Linden, too. It's like it's slowly picking up.
Yeah.
They're in a very different market than, well, they do kind of, they do some of that.
They get down into that ad hoc market that we do as well down there sometimes, but they don't stick it out like we have. Which you have to give the company credit. You know, it used to be, you'd go through a dry spell and people would panic and boom, okay, that's that.
Right.
But we stuck it out, you know, and we're going with the highs and the lows, and we've kept our staffing as is. You know, in fact, we've actually just upgraded two captains here, and we just put on two first officers. So yeah, it's slow and whatnot growth wise, but we've stuck it out with
right.
What
you
we've
haven't
got.
Furloughed.
We haven't
you've
done
kept your pilot. Yeah. Kept your pilot pool.
Yeah.
So when did Laredo start?
Laredo started about 5 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
So 2009.
Yeah,
or so.
Around there, and that's we kind of started going down there, and really we hit it right off the bat down there. We got into kind of almost a scheduled run. We would go to Puebla, Mexico. We'd go out of Laredo to Puebla, Mexico, pick up a load, come back to Laredo. We'd swap crews, clear customs, and then take them out to Hickory, I believe it's North Carolina. And then come back.
Is this car parts?
No, it's mostly car. That was all car parts.
Okay.
We've done other stuff. We did some for actually a lot of the stuff kind of started with the Haiti relief because we went down there and did some of that out of Miami. We did a handful of trips into Haiti, and then that kind of broke off and into the Laredo thing.
Okay.
And we've been doing that. So we've done a little bit of that. I mean, we'll haul band equipment around for concerts and stuff like that on occasion, not
right.
very often.
Out of Laredo.
Yeah.
So the Haiti was kind of the impetus, like, is up until then it was very Alaska.
Yeah.
You were
an
Alaskan company, and that was it. And that kind of sort of got the idea, there's stuff.
There's more to do down south. So it's, you know, we went down there and we did a little bit of that. And I can't remember exactly how many trips we did into Haiti, but it wasn't a lot, but it was maybe five or six trips we did.
Okay.
And then, like I say, that kind of bled off into, well, let's just leave the airplane over here. You know, Laredo's kind of always been a hotbed for parking airplanes for, you know, Linden goes there,
right.
We go there, that and Ypsilanti, Michigan, you know, they're kind of the
what's up with Laredo? Is it cheap parking, good airport, good...
All those things.
Okay.
Cheap parking, good airport. You know, it's a border town, so the stuff can come... A lot of times, stuff will come just right across the border, and we take a lot of loads just straight out of Laredo and go places.
Okay, it comes over in the truck, and you just fly
yeah,
out.
Yeah, a lot of times. Or sometimes we'll just go, you know, it's close. You know, nowhere we go in Mexico is more than an hour away.
Right.
So... Or maybe an hour and a half at the most, but so and it just makes a good 24-hour customs. It's just kind of a
that's like an Alaskan run. I mean, most of your flights here are 1 to 2 hours away.
Yeah, yeah.
Bethel's a little bit closer.
Right, right.
You don't run out. Nobody goes to Dutch Harbor with jets anymore, do they?
No, not anymore. Alaska used to, and Mark Air did, obviously. But
I was wondering if you might on charters or you need a special aspect for that.
We don't do Dutch Harbor, but we have done ADAC, Shimia,
okay.
Cold Bay, obviously. In fact, we went to Cold Bay last night, I think. Those, so we do a little bit down there, you know, not too much. The Shimia thing was actually a civilian. We hadn't been down there in years because we used to do it in the 27 all the time, but the 27 had the legs to go straight there.
Right.
Where this thing,
so your range is a little shorter with it.
It's okay. You can fuel up and come back, but to go down with a load, it's and you know, and the volatility of the weather down there and the lack of quality alternates
limits it.
It limits it pretty much.
Do you see? I know we're kind of moving into what the company does now. Do you see the company trying to do more stuff down in the lower 48 or maybe international? Are they thinking that way at all?
The company obviously wants to grow that way. I mean, right. It's we've been searching for any kind of ACMI contract that we can get, and actually we did get one about 3 years ago. About 3 years ago we had a contract with a company called Bax Global. And they were and they were the old Burlington Express. They used to fly the DC-8s, you know, and whatnot. And they had an operation in Toledo, and they based us in Fort Lauderdale. And we had a run that would go every night Fort Lauderdale to Nashville to Toledo, and then turn around and go back, you know, hit each stop on the way back. And we did that for, you know, and it was they hired us and said, well, we're going to do this on a trial basis. We're going to do 3 months, see how it goes. 3 months, they were happy, everything was going good, and then Bax Global decided to close their doors. The flying just went away.
Right.
So that was kind of our foot in the door to ACMI, but we're always looking for one for those types of things. We had a possibility of one last year with DHL.
Okay.
But that didn't pan out.
And you've kind of got the extra plane down in Laredo that can jump on those if they come up.
And that's kind of the whole premise of the Laredo thing as well was, you know, we had three airplanes up here. It started out with, you know, we had three airplanes. It was two airplanes we'd operate the schedule with and a maintenance spare.
Right.
Well, let's do something with the maintenance spare. So they stuck it down in Laredo and said, you know, hey, it's our maintenance spare. We can have it back here in 8 hours. So we've actually had to... We've had to call that option every once in a while when we've had an airplane that, you know, has whatever maybe
issue going on,
some sort of issue that grounds it for 3 or 4 days, and we'll bring the airplane back up.
Okay, and like you said, it's inexpensive to house it down there. Maintenance down there.
We do have maintenance down there. It's not technically a base for us.
We kind of
operate it as a satellite sort of thing.
Yeah.
But we have mechanics down there. We have a small warehouse down there on the airport that we store, you know, parts and whatnot in. And we put our crews up down there. Right now it's like I say, not a base. We're paying for transportation back and forth. We're per diem hotel, so the guys go down there and they do their thing.
Yeah, that's interesting because Northern Air, the big advantage was the draw was that you were home every night.
Right.
And I've talked to your pilots about that, and they actually like Laredo.
Yeah,
it's like a two-on, two-off schedule.
Yeah, it ends up. It ends up. We try to give the guys a 14 days off, you know, so whatever that turns out to be, in you know, with the days in the month. But we tried to do 14 days off. A lot of cases, we have to travel them on a day off, which nobody has to. But usually, a lot of times, guys don't mind because we do pay extra for that.
Okay,
you know, so for a deadhead, a guy can make a pretty good chunk of change. You know, we can make almost 6 hours. 6.5 hours of pay over guarantee if it's a day off, plus on top of the stage length of the travel and this, that, and the other thing. So there is a lot of those guys. It goes very junior on our captain side.
Right.
And it goes very senior on our first officer side. So there's a group of first officers. You know, we have probably a handful of guys that don't even live up here in the state. They live Washington, Montana, wherever else in the country.
Okay, that may increase with the if you have more bases.
If we were to actually say boom, base Laredo, you're on your own. The company doesn't have plans to do at this point, but you never know what happens if they finally decide. You know, this we've been here for 5 years. We aren't going anywhere. It's time
costing a lot to shuttle people back and forth.
Yeah, it's time to grow roots and make it a real deal. But so far that hasn't been. It's been discussed a few times, but it's and the company's very, you know, because when they first started talking about it to them and said, hey, Laredo is no place to take your family and raise your family, and they're very cognizant of that, and they don't want so they know that if Laredo if we were to open a base down south, most likely it won't be in Laredo. You know, we've looked at San Antonio, we've looked at Austin. You know, places that are a little more palatable to take your family to.
Right, so people could actually live there.
Exactly.
Otherwise, it'll always be a rotational where it's 14 days on for you, some sort of version of that.
And the other issue with Laredo is it's a horrible place to try to commute out of. At least if you were in San Antonio or Austin, you know, you got a lot more air service. Laredo has about 4 or 5 flights a day that go in and out of there.
So
all American Eagle or Continental Express. So it's not an easy place to get in and out of.
Yeah,
you're going either through Dallas or Houston, and it's just
It's one thing if you've got a bought because you guys buy the tickets down there, but if people are trying to go on their, you know, days off and their jumps eating back and forth, right. It would become a...
It'd be an issue. People would be eating up some of their days off, and so the company, you know, they know they don't want to open a base in Laredo, but unfortunately Laredo is the... We get a lot of trips by just being in Laredo, and we save, you know, if we were to open a base in, say, San Antonio or even Austin, you know, now to pick up a trip in Laredo, we're going to have to do that extra leg of starting in San, you know, and going down there.
Get to Laredo from there.
And it's 20 minutes, you know, San Antonio to Laredo is a 20-minute flight. And it's kind of a waste of a cycle, really.
Yeah, and duty day and extra everything else adds up. So. But meanwhile, your bulk of your operations are still in Alaska.
Exactly, yeah.
And people can be home every night.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, it's an awesome schedule.
Yeah, our core business is in Alaska, and as far as I know, tends to stay in Alaska.
Right.
You know, obviously there are always challenges to that if bypass mail rules change or, you know, whatever may come about.
Right.
But the core business is here in Alaska, and there's just unfortunately not a lot of opportunity for growth with the jet and everything. You know, for us to really kind of expand what we do, we almost have to take a step backwards into a turboprop of some sort.
Right.
And
in
say,
the state.
Yeah, exactly. And say, you know, okay, you know, maybe we take that step backwards and put a turboprop up on the slope for a while or something. But
yeah.
So right now, yes, it's great. Everybody, you know, people can be home every night, you know, and be with their families and eat dinner or you know, have breakfast. One of the two. We kind of try to keep it divvied up into an AM and PM type of schedule.
Yeah.
And so guys that don't mind flying all night, you know, they can fly all night. Guys that don't mind getting up early in the morning, they can be home in the evenings, you know. So.
Well, and like I was saying before we turned the recording on, at watching your pilots for the last couple of years with Ryanair, and I know with Northern Air, you've seen all the ups and downs, but everyone just seems pretty happy, which is just a nice... Everybody knows what they're getting. There are no surprises. Right. If they're going to Laredo, they know what that is.
Right.
And,
you know, there's no surprises. And, you know, and there's, like we've talked to you, said, you know, there's people that are unhappy. And unfortunately, sometimes people get caught up in things, and instead of trying to make the best of what they got, they'd rather just complain about it,
right?
You know, and rather than just kind of look back and say, you know, take it into account. You know, I've worked, like I said, it'll be 23 years here in another 12 days that I've worked at this company, and it's had its ups and downs. Of course, I met my wife here at this company. I got an airplane. I live on an airport out in Palmer.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I'm living the dream, you know. I mean, not to brag or anything, but you know, and I don't make a stellar amount of money. You know, pilots can make more than I do, but you know, I make a comfortable living, and I'm happy.
That's true at a few airlines I know, and it's always kind of weird that. And I think they'd say, "Well, you're home every night."
Yeah, well, a lot of our guys are too.
A lot of responsibility.
So,
When I was younger, I used to change airlines trying to find the perfect one. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I discovered was there is no perfect airline.
Right.
And you're better off as long as, you're better off sitting where you are and saying, looking what's good about an airline. And
if you can, you know, look here. At, you know, are they pushing me to go every 10 minutes? Are they, you know, are they sitting there whining at me? Oh, you got to go, you got to do this.
Or your guys aren't.
Or, you know, or are they giving you, well, so-and-so's going, or, you know, and we used to run into a lot of that here. Well, Alaska Airlines just took off. Well, Everett's just took off.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what? I don't care if Everett's just took off, okay?
Yeah.
The weather is what it is, you know, and I've learned a lot over the years, actually, from a lot of the older guys that used to work here that, you know, and it's like, you know, let the company make the decision. The weather's marginal. Hey, there's
a 50-50
chance. Say again?
You have a dispatcher.
Yeah, we do.
Make that call.
Yeah, yeah. I say, hey, you know, but, you know, we have a traffic office that sits over there and, you know, I'm just like, hey, it's your and like I told guys, I said, it's your gas while we're here on the ground. It's my gas when we get in the air.
Right.
So I'm going to do what I need to do. If I don't like it when I get there, I'm not going to try. I'm not going to go run myself out of gas.
Trying to do
multiple approaches, and in the jet you can't. You pretty much got one shot at it.
And then you're alternate.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that we know all the old days where it was much more loosey goosey, and you give it an extra college try.
Right.
Minimums.
Right.
Okay, those are awesome. But
those are just advisory.
Yeah, it's definitely... jump seating back in the mid-90s with you guys, the crews were always a little more I don't want to say stressed, but it's a little more like, you know, should we go, should we not go now? And I've sat here and jump-seated, and the crews are always relaxed, and it's a nice environment.
You know, and we were just discussing, we've had kind of had a run of the weather, the Nome Cots weather here lately, which are our two morning flights. The forecasts have been good every morning, but about the time we get there, the weather just falls on its tail.
Fog
rolls in off the water. And so here over lately, but I was just discussing it with the training manager the other day. We don't generally miss a lot of here, mainly because we make the decisions here in Anchorage.
Right.
You know, we look at it and we're like, you know, and the company's like, you know what, I don't want to spend a bunch of, I don't want to go waste a bunch of gas if it's going to be marginal. You know, we've got to have a better than average chance to get in. Otherwise, let's just do something else.
Yeah, and you can't shoot the approach unless you have minimums. If you get minimums, you tend to get in.
Yes.
If you've got the minimum, that's what they are.
Yeah.
So the future of Northern Air Cargo, you're thinking maybe, and I know nobody, you don't have any hard answers, and I'm sure it's upper management decisions, but adding jets or adding, changing planes?
We're always looking. Yeah, I mean, we're kind of staring at refleeting right now. The 200s are getting kind of like the 27s were. They're getting to be a little bit labor intensive here lately. So, yeah, there are different airplanes in our future, for sure.
Right.
A good portion of those, I believe, will always be a jet operator in some form or other, but I wouldn't rule out a step backwards possibly into a turboprop at some point as well.
Right, with all cargo, no thought of passengers.
No thought. Our parent company, I don't think, has any real interest. They're involved in a lot of, they do a lot of maritime. Our Salt Truck, our parent company, they do a lot of maritime stuff, but it's all and it's all freight hauling.
Like,
you know, and that's kind of their freight logistics and everything are kind of their what they've picked, and I don't think the passenger industry doesn't interest them at all.
Okay.
And so, and I'm speaking that from thoughts of them.
Anything
you know,
could change.
But yeah, and anything could change. But I think for the most part, I don't see us, you know, doing any passenger operating. I think it'll be cargo for the future that I foresee.
Okay. When it comes to hiring pilots, what are you looking for?
Well, our book minimums are pretty much just standard ATP stuff.
Right.
We've run into, FAA has made some new rules about how we hire, who we hire, and things like that. What has, like we talked before, what generally works good for us is guys that have some twin turbine time, have that instrument time, you know, they've worked in the environment, but yet they've done enough VFR work to be good pilots,
right?
You know, that kind of stuff. Like I say, guys that come out of the 1900 from Little Ace have all transitioned really well into here. You know, so, and technically, so I kind of put my, when I'm looking at resumes, look at what kind of flying they're doing, and the twin turbine time. I have a general preference for guys here in Alaska.
Right.
I mean, I'm not gonna lie, because this is where the company is based. You know, if I hire somebody from down south, you know, most of the guys that we have living down south, we hired with the idea that they were going to be here, but you know, they were able to move down south, you know, and get to the seniority point to where they know that they can bid that Laredo stuff and be able to do that, you know. But you know, around the 5,000 hour mark seems to be people work really well, you know.
Okay.
That twin turbine time. We have hired guys straight out of caravans and Navajos and stuff like that. They tend to, we've had some guys do really well at it. We've had some guys that have tended to struggle with it a little bit.
So is that more the people that have come talk to you a lot and you just know who they are? I mean, is there a, or are you taking resumes for twin turbine jobs and you're just saying, yeah, this company, they fly twin turbine?
To be 100% honest with you, I get a lot of recommendations from the guys, from other pilots, you know. The guys from Little Ace, they'll come into my office and say, hey, so-and-so is a really good guy, or hey, so-and-so's, you know, so I have a tendency to take those to heart, because if somebody's coming in saying so-and-so is a good guy and this, that, and generally they are, and people are going to, you know, they're going to be good guys to fly with.
As if they're going to get along
Exactly, you know, they're not, you know, I haven't had any trouble with the guys that I've hired from Little Ace. They've all been just spectacular.
Mesh right in.
Yeah, mesh right in. And like I say, you know, so we've had really good luck with that, and kind of sticking with that theme of the, you know, and those guys, you know, a lot of those guys, you know, those guys, they kind of start over there. So right. usually about the 5,000 hour mark, they're about, you know,
ready to move on.
They, you know, well, and they get that in 5 years. You know, that's,
yeah.
that's
yeah,
not or,
used
or
to
less.
Be they get that 3 years.
right. so, but yeah, you know, so that, you know, just the just working in the environment, but yet having that, it's nice to, it's nice that they have that, you know, I flew a 207 or flew a, just done some VFR work.
When
know,
they
where,
started, probably when they
yeah,
started
exactly.
out, and then they moved
the,
to...
Got some of those early flying skills that really stick with you through, yeah. through your career.
How do you think that translates to the international stuff in Laredo? Is there any issues with the guys who've flown up here a whole lot, and they go down there? They're
not just... really. It's Mexico, the flying in Mexico is... It's the biggest challenge with it is understanding the controls.
Right.
Yeah. It really and that's not a dig on anything, but you know, you sometimes and the worst thing you want to hear a Mexican controller tell you is I've got a reroute for you.
yes.
You're gonna sit and you're gonna ask him, oh, okay, well, how did that, you know, this, that, and you know.
Yeah.
But that's probably the hardest transition, you know, getting used to doing the customs thing, that's no big deal.
Just takes a matter time
of,
or two
yeah, do, once you do it once or twice, and usually you're going to be down there with a more experienced guy, and it can kind of lead you through it and whatnot.
Right, you're not, your first stints down there is not likely to be as a captain.
No,
you're probably going to go down.
You're going to go down as an FO and whatnot. But you know, there are the other challenges are the high. You know, it's all mountainous terrain. It's all high, hot, you know, and stuff like that. So it takes, you know. I remember my first couple trips into Mexico were taken off fully loaded. You're, you know, the runways are really long down there for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, you're just running down the runway going, okay, it's about, you know, we'd have been off in Anchorage, you know, about 2,000 feet back, you know.
I did that. I do some airplane ferrying. Uh-huh. In April, I took a plane to Islamabad, and I brought one back from Islamabad, taking off out of Oman. They didn't have a fuel truck available, so I didn't leave till Oman until about 2 in the afternoon.
Ooh.
And it was like 43 degrees C.
Wow.
And, you know, I've got ferry tanks full of fuel.
Right.
So I'm, you know, you can go like, what, 110% of gross, 130% of gross weight.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a huge runway, but yeah, you're just, it's a caravan. It's like, come on, I just used 8,000 feet.
Right. You can fly by now.
Yeah. It's like, so huh. Probably the same idea. That's remember the first time I did hot and high, I was shocked at
right.
how.
Right, right.
Different it was.
Yeah.
In a jet, you're going that much faster.
So. Right. So it takes, that's the other thing, getting, you know, and all the approaches down there, there's no GPS approaches in Mexico.
Okay.
So it's all, there are a lot of ILSs, a lot of VOR approaches, and a lot of these big kind of arcs to your final approach where you're coming in from all, I mean, they do, it's nothing,
not always,
it's not hard.
Not always vectors.
In Mexico, it's almost never vectors. I think their radars, they don't have, it's so mountainous, and the terrain is so varied down there that I don't think radars, maybe up at altitude they've got it, but below 18,000, which is only 8,000 feet off the ground in a lot of cases.
Yeah,
I shouldn't say that, but that's kind of an exaggeration, but, you know, some of those airports are pretty high.
Huh. That's, I hadn't thought about that down there. That makes sense. So, I mean, Laredo actually is different. It would be, as a pilot, it would be, like you said, especially with an FO, when you're not as used to it,
mm-hmm. yeah.
switching back and forth between Alaska and Laredo would be pretty cool.
And you know, the guys go down there. You know, to be honest with you, for me, flying in Alaska, I would much rather do than fly down there.
Yeah,
those big thunderstorms that those guys have, that people have down there, and the dodge and all that stuff doesn't interest me at all. I'll stick up here and play with the quick changing weather and the fog and this, that, and the other. I can deal with that. I've dealt with it. But those guys flying down there in those thunderstorms and skirting the edges of them and landing during them and this, that, and the other thing, and just like, you know,
a lot more wind shear.
I think, you know, those guys, that's as challenging a flying as it is up here.
I would agree. When I started the ferry flying, I flew in Central Africa for a while, and that's, you know, I had a certain arrogance having flown in Alaska for a long time, and I was like, Alaska, we're kind of the best pilots anywhere.
Right.
And then you get out there, you're like, oh, man, these other places have different challenges that are every bit as scary.
Right.
And
right.
I know pilots who have dealt with thunderstorms forever, and they're just like, oh, yeah, it's easy. You just do this, and you weather radar.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm terrified.
Exactly. How far away do I really need to be from that thing, you know? And
give me some fog rolling it off the ocean.
Right. So, it's a... flying anywhere has its challenges, and that's the good thing about this job. you go down there, you get some experience flying in the environment down south. You up here, you get kind of the best of both worlds.
You guys keep growing, and it looks like your growth is conservative.
It is
very slow, much so. and mm-hmm. see how it goes.
And and that can change in a heartbeat too. Like that DHL thing that we were possibly going to get, that was going to be huge for us. That was going to be kind of the put Northern Air Cargo on the map type growth, which made me really nervous.
Yeah,
I don't like that big instant growth. Next thing we're operating four or five airplanes that in a place that we've been, in a place that we've never been. And, I like the incremental slow. The upper end doesn't like to hear that, but I like to. I like to hear the. I like to see. Okay, we're going to take one airplane. We're going to put it here, and we're going to do this with it.
Yeah.
Okay, I can live with that.
I've worked at a place that did the massive growth, and there were some good things about it, but there were some big downsides to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to keep it safe.
Yeah,
because it's hard to keep track of it.
Right.
But at least if you're down there and you're using the IFR system, it's not as hard.
Yeah,
it's no, up here it can get goofier.
Right, right.
So, cool. Well, anything else you'd like to add?
No, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
You too. This is one of I've been wanting to talk to you about this for a while. But this is one of the legendary Alaskan companies.
It is, and it's been, like I said, I've worked here for 23 years, and it's been a great company to me.
Yeah.
I've had my moments at times when I've got sick and tired of this place, sick and tired of this particular position. it's been a great place to work. It's afforded me a lot of freedom in my life. I get to do, I live on an airport out in the valley. I'm real happy with this place.
Do you still get on Fly the Line periodically?
I do. They wanted me to fly this afternoon, but it was kind of a possibility flight this afternoon. But
right.
I'd probably go fly tomorrow. But I can. It's kind of one of those I can fly as little or as much as I want.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I get tied up with things in here sometimes, and I'll go a month without go flying the line or something.
But yeah.
It's one of those things that I just gotta push the stuff aside and just go get on a flight and go do it.
And then you get to put the office behind you.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know the chief pilot position with every company that I know is a very underappreciated position.
Yeah.
You're sort of the liaison between management and pilots.
Right.
And that nobody's ever happy with you, and you end up doing a lot of work.
Right, right, right. So, but it's not bad. And I took this job mainly because, like I said, it afforded me, while flying, I could do, what really happened was, I shouldn't say this, but what's happened last year and what's keeping me kind of holding on to this and not going back to Fly the Line. And my son started playing ice hockey, and I've always been a big ice hockey fan.
Yeah, you said you were going to try to go to college.
That's what I wanted. That was what I wanted to do when I left high school, because that's what was important at the time to me. But my son started playing last year, and I coached his team, and I really, really enjoyed doing that. And so I'm going to do that again this year, and we'll see how it goes. If it goes good again this year, I'll probably stick it out, but otherwise I would like to get back to flying the line.
I heard when I was trying to figure out who the chief pilot was here a couple years ago, they said there are two of you that kind of go back and forth on the job sometimes.
No.
I don't know who the other guy was. You've been here for a while.
I've been in this position for the last 3 years.
Yeah, that's plenty of time.
It's there was the guy before me did it for about 2 years. So it's this job. Nobody sticks around in this job that long. If I make it to year four, which will be next April, I'll be sitting in this office the longest anybody has in a while.
Yeah, but no intention of leaving the company. Just
fly. I just want to go back and fly.
Yeah,
it's like I say, this is
you're a pilot for me.
Exactly, and then I want to go back. Some days I don't feel much like a pilot because I feel like a babysitter.
Yeah,
I don't mean that in a bad way, but
that's what every chief pilot I've talked to is. So being a pilot, I understand that. So you're happy with the Aces this year?
Oh yeah, they did awesome.
Yeah.
So I was hoping the Rangers are going to win the Cup, but it's not looking good for those guys.
So your son's in high school playing?
No, he's just a mite level.
He's
8 years old. So
okay,
so he'll be a squirt this year at the squirt level.
So you can still have high hopes that.
Yeah. As long as he's having fun, I've always enjoyed hockey.
Yeah.
I like being a part of it. So and the fact is that he's enjoying it too makes it great.
Yeah. That's cool.
So, if he takes some runs with it and wants to, you know, try to go play college hockey too, that'd be even great. But if he doesn't, you know, it kind of got me back into it, and I think I'll stick with coach of youth hockey.
Yeah,
whether he's doing it or not for a while.
My little brother's doing triathlons, and I've been coaching him for the last 7-8 months, and it's actually a lot of fun coaching someone to do. I don't go through the pain of the event.
Right,
I can just. Right. Tell him what to do.
Exactly. Why aren't you doing
it? Why didn't you get that workout in? It's only an 80-miler.
Right.
So. Cool, awesome. Well, I'll let you get back to work.
And okay, well, it was good talking to you.
Yeah.
Where are you headed next?
I go back to Seattle. I was up on the mountain. I froze my fingers. I was going to say, that's not a weird disease. That's a little frostbite.
No, that's definitely frostbite.
Yeah. It was a long trip on the mountain this year.
Yeah.
So, but
did
I get,
you go all the way to the...
I did. I guided, so I got five of my climbers up to the summit.
Nice. Excellent.
We had one guy fall down the line, not one of our guys, a solo guy fell down the fixed line and bounced off five of my climbers on the way up. It was it's kind of an epic trip. But,
I bet.
I go back to Seattle, and I'll do. Still got a check ride with Ken Moore.
Okay.
So probably one training flight, and a check ride, and the Beaver on floats. And
nice.
IOE, and I'll be... I like the round engines.
Yeah, I do too. So. It's my thing.
Yeah, well, you got the T6
yeah,
to play
I got that.
With in a few years.
Yeah, and actually I go to the air races every year, too.
Oh, do you?
And so go watch those things bend the sticks out there. It's pretty
fun. Hopefully not crash and burn.
Yeah, no, I was there for that. That was really fun.
That was a bad one. But. Cool, excellent. Well, Nate, thanks for sitting down and talking, and this is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. Over and out.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.